The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Well, good morning, and good morning, everyone. Welcome to IMC. One of the interesting areas of mindfulness is the topic or the area of identity, the identities we carry, the identities that we inherit, the identities that we are assigned. And it's a very modern issue in many ways, because it's kind of gotten highlighted more and more in the modern era. And so much so that I think that I wonder sometimes whether our scientific Latin name for our species is Homo sapien variety sapien, and whether it should be Homo sapien variety identificarus, the knowing humans who know themselves so well that they can build up identities and have identities and differentiate each other by their so-called identities. I feel like it's a little bit difficult topic to talk about, partly because it's possible to cause a lot of suffering around this topic of identity, and I don't want to hurt anyone. And also because there is a lot of suffering already around topics of identity and who we are and who we're allowed to be, and all kinds of things. I read recently that one of the strong, apparently, characteristics of left-wing politics in the United States in the 1950s had to do with labor issues. And one of the strong left-wing kind of topics of the last decade or so has been identity politics, issues of particular groups and supporting them, especially groups that have been oppressed and whose identity has been kind of forced into their lives as an issue, sometimes against their will, you know. But because people who are oppressed, they sometimes have to stand up and protest or stand up for themselves. And in fact, the term identity politics came out of people who were in the civil rights movement, who were standing up, and people whose identities were assigned to them, by, in some sense, by others, or at least created, or kind of was made meaningful by other people in such a way that they were oppressed for having that identity. And there are many, many kinds of identities that we carry with us, and they change over a lifetime. They change in different circumstances of our lives and where we are. And you might be visit your parents, and your identity then becomes much more highlighted as a child of your parents. Or you might visit your children, and your identity as a parent becomes, and that can all happen in one day if you're lucky enough. You know, go back and forth, and you have to negotiate, you know, when you're supposed to be a child and when you're supposed to be a parent. And then later on you're with your partner, and you better not be either of those. And so you have to figure out how you're going to move between all these things. And it goes on, it can go be many more in the course of a day. And all of these can come with how we want to define ourselves, how we see ourselves, how other people define ourselves, how other people see us. And it can get quite complicated, and how do we negotiate and find our way? And then it shifts over a lifetime as well, some aspects of these identities. And so how do we relate to it? How do we hold it? And then we have this, you know, issue around Buddhism, that Buddhism has this teaching of not-self. And so how does this teaching of not-self fit into the idea of identity? And are we not supposed to have an identity if there's no self? And how do we manage this? So I want to start with a couple of maybe thought experiments, or first an example. It being summer, maybe of this particular summer of 2017, I took a little more time than I usually do to clean my office. And some of the things that were on my desk had been there for probably 10, 12 years. So, you know, a certain level of making order of it was called for. And so I made a lot of order, and the desk is pretty clear, except for things that are current, a few little things. And I even took time to line up the front of all the books, my bookcase. They're all kind of straight along, you know, rather than all haphazard there. And so you go in, and then someone happened to coincidentally at the same time gave me a potted plant. So I put that on the table, and so it looks kind of nice compared to how it used to. So now when I go in there, I'm not going to take a piece of paper or a book and just kind of toss it on the table or put it in other stacks of paper. Because as soon as I put one little thing down, it kind of makes a big impact on the overall cleanliness and uncluttedness of the place. Whereas 2 months ago or so, even a month ago, one more piece of paper, one more thing on the book, on the table, and on the floor made no difference, you know, almost, right? Because it just kind of like was already messy. So if you clear and clean things out, sometimes it creates a very different perspective with which we see things and which we relate to things. So meditation can have this function as well. Meditation can be kind of a house cleaning or office cleaning, depending how you relate to your mind. And so in this thought experiment, imagine that you can sit down. Imagine that you've been really obsessed about something. You know, your favorite obsession or something, one of the big obsessions of your lifetime, and something that maybe really bothered you and was there a lot and so stressful to have. So sorry to bring it up again. but remember how it was to be obsessed. And then imagine that you're able to sit down and meditate. In the course of the meditation session, the obsession quieted down. There's less energy in it, less force in it. It didn't have you by the throat so strongly. And then, lo and behold, near the end of the meditation, it just kind of faded away. And your mind was quite peaceful and calm, at ease. And in fact, it occurred to you to think this way, are there any thoughts? You would answer no. Not recognizing, of course, that that was one. Because it's quite quiet and peaceful. So there's almost like no thoughts whatsoever. Peaceful and nice. And then the meditation comes to an end. And it occurs to you, you have to open your eyes and start your life. And then you remember your obsession. But at this point, it's not an obsession, it's just a thought, the topic. And you're kind of like, you're peaceful, and you kind of look up at it, or whatever it is, and you say, wow, I don't have to get involved in that. I don't have to get it right now, at this moment, think about that. I think I just experienced one of the more peaceful times of my life. Maybe I don't have to give it up for a moment. Maybe I can just stay and not rush headlong back into my obsession. And in fact, when I notice the thought arises, that's just a particular activity of the mind. And I'm much more than that. I'm a bigger, wider, fuller, functioning being than that particular thought, that obsession. And then it might occur to you, but you know, just earlier in the day, that was the way the way I was obsessing about this, there wasn't any room to recognize anything more about my life or life at all. My whole world has kind of gotten really small around this particular obsession. But that was an activity of the mind, an action of the mind, an involvement of the mind to be involved in that activity. And I can really see it now as an activity of the mind that I have some choice over at this moment. And because I have some choice in my peaceful state, I'm going to choose not to pick it up. I'm going to stay contented, at peace. Just breathing is enough. Just being alive is enough. That there's nothing I have to prove, nothing I have to fix, nothing I have to do at this moment. That's a remarkable perspective to have. And one of the functions of meditation, for some people who can do this, is to get quiet enough, peaceful enough, so we can have that perspective on what the activities of the mind is doing, what the mind is doing. So one of the things that we can see from this kind of perspective is that when we pick up or get involved with identifications, when the action of identifying, because one of the characteristics of important, abstract human thinking is to put things into categories and to identify certain things as certain, you know, one thing or the other. If you want to drink soup, it's good to identify what the spoon is as opposed from the fork. So it's a useful thing to do that. Or if someone says, go to the kitchen and get a spoon. Sometimes we do that with people. If we have a medical emergency here at IMC, we would like to identify the people who are medically trained, which we've done before here. A couple of times people have collapsed in the middle of meditation or during a talk, and I would ask, we have a doctor or a nurse here. And people, you know, that's a useful identification to have. So there's a lot of useful identities that we have, and they have functions. And so you can, you know, so, but if you're peaceful and quiet, you can see it as not as a something that is ordained by nature, to mean this is how it is, but we can see that the mind is involved in thinking those thoughts. And even though it might have some truth out there, some people are medically trained, for example, it has some truth out there, the interesting question is, what is the activity in the mind with how we think about it, how we hold it? So if I see the spoon as a spoon, that's pretty innocent. But if one of you says, no, that's a fork, and then I'll say, no, it's a spoon. No, it's a fork. We can have a war. In Zen, a Zen person would never fight over what they called the spoon or this thing that you slurp the soup with. They would not get involved in the argument, what it is. They would just pick it up and start drinking from this thing that has a little scoop in it. So it's possible to get involved in the identifying activity of the mind in a contracted way, in a forceful way, in an insistent way, in an opinionated way, in an anxious way, kind of really get involved and get tight and involved. And it's possible not to do that, just let it drop, be peaceful. We can watch the difference between that. And that difference, seeing that difference, gives us a very different information about what we're involved in than we are if we just go headlong into the concern, into identity. So it's how we hold the identity, how we relate to it, that is a very important part of Buddhist practice. It doesn't solve all the identity questions that people have. It's not the final answer to it. But it creates a very different context approach for being able to address the issues, because the mind is at a little bit more calm, settled, more open, so that it can maybe look at it in a less and less biased way, or less and less contracted way, or less and less anxious way, or forceful way on top of it. So to be able to calm down and see. So what are some of the things that we can see? One of the things that's pretty clear is when other people put us into an identity. So some people, they see us through our role. So someone volunteered to help with the medical emergency here. That was nice. But that every time they come to IMC, like all these people are gravitating towards them. I have a question. and so, you know, people now are starting to identify them into narrower scope than they prefer to be. In a certain context, they're okay to be medical support, but they're much more than that. Or people see us as you know, in relationship to our partner. We're a husband or a wife, or people see us as a parent. in different settings, people will relate to us in different ways. When my son was going to all these little league things, or going to these, you know, to school, elementary school and stuff, it was clearly who I was in the eyes of the other parents. I was a parent. And, you know, my whole role was to be a parent. And if they wanted to know about me, they wanted to know about parenting. It's like, you know, that's how they saw me. It kind of makes kind of sense. That's what we shared at the time. Sometimes people see us through painful identification. They identify us in painful ways. Maybe once upon a time, we, you know, got irritated with someone or that they saw us or with them. And now every time we see them, we feel this cautious around. They're cautious around. They step back and they don't want to relate to us. Sometimes there's a lot of prejudice and bias in our society, and so people are put in categories. It's a dangerous person or somehow a person that shouldn't be here, or all kinds of things. and people can feel, we can feel that sometimes, that you know, that we're put in these categories, and it's very painful. That the way other people identify us, the other way people define us, and that can be seen. We can also see sometimes how people do it to themselves. And sometimes, you know, that we want to just shake some people, like, you know, drop it. Because they have such strong ways of being self-deprecating or self-critical. Like, I'm bad, I'm wrong, somehow I'm unworthy. And it's very, very powerful that people identify themselves this way. These are abstract ideas that the mind produces, the mind creates. And what happens when we can able to see the creation, the formation of thoughts, ideas, concepts like this, as opposed to the thoughts of I'm unworthy, the thoughts that I'm wrong or something, are not seen as being something created, but seeing as just this is true, this is given. The mind thinks it without us realizing clearly this is a thought, just a thought. And so sometimes we see how other people do this. Sometimes it's forms of arrogance and conceit. I deserve things. I'm special. People should treat me this way. And people walk into a room, and it's clear that they feel like they're in control, or that's who they think they are. So sometimes we can see other people do it. People can see how people treat us that way. What's hardest, I think, for many people, is how we do it to ourselves. And the how we form our own, we do the own identification process. We have ideas of what we need to do, what we should be, what we deserve, our own unworthiness, who we are in relationship to other people. There's a lot of comparative thoughts. I hope people don't notice me. Some people are expert at hiding. When I was younger, I noticed that I played these social games where I was trying to inform people or get people to identify me, see me, in the way that I wanted to define myself. Not who I was, but rather who I wanted them to see me as. And that's that takes, you know, social gymnastics to, you know, that probably was very unsuccessful. So this, what identities do we have? And some of them are appropriate to have. Some of them are clearly empowering, it's helpful for people to have and to realize, wow, I can do this. Like when, you know, the story I tell often of how I was told in seventh grade by an art teacher that I had no artistic ability. And, I didn't care at that time. It had no issue. It was no psychological or personal issue whether I was or did or didn't have artistic ability. So it didn't create any distress for me. But the teacher must know. So I just kind of added that to the set of identities that I carried with me. I'm a person who has no artistic ability. Thank you. And then at some point, in college, I started doing art, and that was great. And to recognize, oh, how nice, I can do this. And so there was some identifying with myself with a certain ability. And that ability, then I took art classes and had a good time. But then in order to take further art classes in college, I had to be an art major. And then I decided that I was an artist. And that was the end of art. So there were some ways it was empowering. The other ways, I took it on too strongly as a way I had to define myself, be seen by others, to prove myself. And that I hadn't been doing art for those reasons. Those were not the reasons I could do it for anymore. So I put it down. And so we have these identities that we travel our life with, and they change over time. In different professions, different jobs, different relationships, different situations, they can change and move. Some people find it very comforting to be around people who are similar because they're free of the oppression, free of the challenges, free of the tensions that can exist when different identities and different kind of identifications are bumping up against each other, especially if they're judgmental of each other or critical of each other or there's an inside and outside group. Some people find it safer to be around people who are not like them, because if we're always around people who are similar, then sometimes we don't see clearly what we're doing. We don't see the mindset. We don't see the identifications that we have, the self-definitions we have. And so then that can be a little bit unsafe because it's kind of a groupthink that goes on. So when is it good to be around diverse people? When is it nice to be around similar people who identify the same way? It kind of morphs and changes. It oscillates. I think a healthy life is one that moves fluidly between different roles, different identities, different things that go on. The Buddha was clearly opposed to the idea that people are born into certain identities in his time. But rather that people are identified, he said, by the actions they do, how they live their lives. So, if someone is a farmer, if someone farms, then they're a farmer. If someone rules, then they're a king. If someone is a manual labor, back then they were manual labor. So that you were defined by the actions you do. And that allowed for fluidity. People can then move between different identities. I've known people who've had a particular sexual orientation, that was their identity. And then they found surprise that it changed later in life. And so some of them found that awkward to make that shift. Sometimes it was awkward for their friends and family. But can we be fluid to rather than holding people in something, to really allow people the freedom to live their lives the way that it wants to be lived this time, and to, in a sense, if we want to identify people, identify them by the activity, what they're doing, the actions of what they're doing, how they're living their lives, as opposed to a fixed identity. That's, I think, how the Buddha approached this idea. Whether that's accurate or helpful or not, I don't know. But the idea is that we can start, when we sit and meditate, we can start seeing how the activity of the mind of identifying works. Independent of what is our identity, there's also identifying, the process of identification. And can we see and watch that operate? So the thought experiment I gave earlier was this imaginary idea of being able to completely clear your mind, be peaceful. That vantage point, if you're able to do that, then allows you to see how identifications get reintroduced. So it's like in my office, I can watch the process by which I carelessly reintroduce a mess because it's so clear and clean. I can watch it happen. So then I can maybe choose, well, not today. I'm not going to just throw things down in my office. But sometimes in meditation, or more often than having a clear mind, we learn in the other direction. As the mind begins to see clearly what's going on, as the mind begins to quiet down, then we see where we're caught up, what preoccupations we have, where they our thinking goes, so that we can't calm anymore. And lo and behold, if we kind of use this lens to look at our experience, we'll see that partly what fuels our preoccupation or agitation or busy mind are issues of identification, what we identify with. Not always, but it can, sooner or later, we'll come across them in different ways. For some, and there's many, you know, all the different ways can be there. Because anything that we're preoccupied with or concerned with or holding on to will be revealed until we've let go of it to be able to get more peaceful. So one interesting example of where people identify in meditation, some people identify with what needing to be in control. I have to control this. And if you were trying to control your life and control your experience, it might work for a little while when you meditate, but sooner or later, that sense of identifying with the person in control just gets in the way. That becomes the limiting factor of becoming more peaceful and more settled. Or it might be identifying with someone who has to be successful. I've known a lot of people who suffered, have been trying to be successful in meditation because they wanted to, when they come out of meditation, be able to tell their friends, I'm a good meditator. I just went on a week-long retreat where I kind of, you know, I better have something to show for it, you know, because I'm supposed to come back and be something. And so there's an identity issues come up around it because we need to prove ourselves or be someone in relationship to our friends and people, or we could not be it. I remember there was a man who was, I guess I won't say the religion, but he was some religion, Western religion. He said that he could not go back to his community to tell them he'd been on a Buddhist retreat. It was too threatening, or people would be upset to see him in that way. I know that I've been on a retreat and identified probably with every possible thing you could identify, I think. Just lots of things. Maybe not everything, but... I mean, I've left a retreat thinking, oh, now I'm happy. I'm a happy person. And surprised at how, you know, and then that didn't last long. But that was my identity for a little while. Or then leaving, you know, meditation and feeling, oh, feeling some heaviness and sadness and, oh, I guess this is it. I'm a sad person. You know, and then that, you know, but then something happens and that goes away. And it's been remarkable over this lifetime how many things that I've identified with in the form of, this is the way I'm always going to be. This is it. So I don't know about some of you, but I've been one of those people who have succumbed to the delusion of permanence. This is it. This is who I am. And then life changes. My life over time changes. One of the interesting things in my life, I don't know, I haven't asked other people so much about how it works for them, but I have the impression that my self-image is usually not up to date. That, you know, I'm still operating on an older self-image, you know, that I finally figured out who I am, kind of, and... But then I change, but I change faster than I can keep up with it. And so, you know, so then there's a little tension. I can feel the awkwardness of being in the world, and people see me differently than how I see myself, and I have to kind of figure out how to navigate that with that. So sometimes in meditation we learn about how we identify and how this operates and how we relate to identities in the process of quieting down and getting calmer. Because we see that we're not getting any calmer and start seeing what the attachments are, the concerns, the emotions, the whatever's going on, all the things we add on top of the particular idea of an identity. So for example, you know, currently I'm a male. And I don't hold on to the idea in a tight way that I have to be a male and that I will be a male. There's enough, I've been around enough people in my life, families and friends and people, who genders have shifted over their lifetime. And so, you know, could happen to me, I guess. So, so I have this identity of being a male. Hopefully, I would like to hold it lightly, not to hold on to something that has to be a certain way. Maybe they'll discover new categories and over time or whatever, you know, so hold it lightly. Or I could watch my idea of being a male that, it's a magnet for all kinds of cultural ideas in the societies that I grew up of what it means to be a male and how I have to act and be responsible or be all kinds of things. You can fill in the blanks of what, you know, what it means to be a male. And some of this stuff becomes, you know, sometimes invisible, the identities we have. I suspect that people like myself, who being white, belong a little bit more to the white, more dominant culture in the United States, that it's a little bit invisible, the identities we carry, and are very invisible sometimes, and very invisible to see how other people sometimes treat us or identify us or sometimes defer to us or sometimes because we're white male or something. And I think of it like, no one has an accent in the place where they grew up because everyone's speaking normally there. But in fact, everyone else in other locales, that's an accent, you're from there. So sometimes, we grew up a certain way and things just seem normal, we don't see it. But in fact, there's a tremendous interplay of identities and identifying that we do for ourselves and for others. And for some people, it's really oppressive to live in this world where the identities have play such a big role. And other people who are privileged, like the white male especially, it's like we don't have an accent, and so it's hard to see, how that works and how that operates unless we look at it more carefully and deeply. So meditation, I think, is a very valuable tool to help us not necessarily figure out what is our identity or what identities are useful to carry and to have or how identities work. Let me say it differently. One of the most important things I think meditation can do around the whole issue of identity is help us to see the activity in the mind, the action in the mind of identifying, the identification process of thoughts and ideation. And as we see it as a thought and idea, then we can start seeing how we relate to it. Do we hold it tightly? Do we hold it loosely? Do we believe it automatically? Do we have the delusion of permanence? This is how it is. Do we somehow relate to it in such a way or hold it in such a way that we hurt ourselves? Do we hold it till we hurt others? Does the process of identification stop with ourselves, or do we, in our minds, also create identities of other people? Are they accurate? Are they somehow accurate in some way? And how do we hold those? How do we relate to those? I think that, we are Homo sapien identificus. I can't speak Latin. We are constantly classifying and categorizing people into certain ways of being, something that could be called an identity. And I think we have to learn how to live with that wisely. And to live with it wisely, I think it really helps to see how the mind is involved in the process of identifying. And how the heart or emotional life or psychological life holds it, relates to it, believes it, doesn't believe it. And if we can step back far enough to see it clearly as thoughts and ideas, we can discover freedom in the midst of it. And it's possible to discover through meditation, for example, a quality of a peaceful mind, a settled heart, that we don't have to sacrifice, that we don't have to give up when we operate with the identities that are appropriate to operate with. because we don't have to relate to it tightly or forcefully or defensively or whatever. And even those times where we need to be forceful with our identities, or we need to stand up for it, or say stop, or you know, fight for civil rights for our identities. The hope is, I think the hope is, that for people who have meditated and know something about a peaceful inner mind and how the mind operates and functions, that we can find a way to be forcefully engaged in society around the identity issues that our society needs to address, without it, our involvement forcing us or getting us to lose our settled, calm presence that includes so much more of who we are than any particular identity. We are vast. And a person who is, in the early Buddhist tradition, a person who was fully enlightened was sometimes called a person who had a great self, a vast self. So this kind of vastness, we're so much more than any one way. And to find that peacefulness and that openness and then that freedom and fluidity to work through these identity issues is one of the great tasks of spiritual life. So with that, I want to thank you. Hopefully I didn't cause any harm bringing up this, what I think is a difficult topic to bring up, talk about. If I do, I apologize. Thank you.